Good afternoon, and welcome to the Early Life Exposures, Long-Term Health Consequences, Internet Web Series sponsored by the NIEHS Superfund Research Program. This is the third and final session entitled TCE and Phthalates. So I'm Jerry Heindel, and I'm a Scientific Program Administrator at NIEHS, and I'll be the moderator for today's session. So we'll get started in just a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have included short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hotlinked in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have a question and answer session, at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that you keep your phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you're ready to ask a question. To unmute your phone, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or by using your phone's mute button. So that's *6 to mute, *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noise that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and be on *1. If you're on the internet, you should have clicked on the Go to Session icon near the bottom of the page and also should be on *1. Internet participants may ask questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide, and you do not need to wait until the question and answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit a question at any time. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you're encountering. Please include a telephone number where we can reach you so we can help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenters will be announcing the slide numbers as they are moving along their presentations. You may advance to the next slide using the right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number to the left. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentations. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information Archives. So with all of that, we're now ready to start today's session. So let me remind you to keep your phones on mute and do not put us on hold. So for our first presentation today is from Superfund researcher Dr. Anne Aschengrau. Dr. Aschengrau received her doctoral degree in epidemiology from Harvard School of Public Health and has been a member of the faculty of Boston University School of Public Health for more than 25 years. She currently holds professional appointments as professor and associate chairman in the Department of Epidemiology. She has authored nearly 100 publications, focusing mainly on the health effects of environmental pollution, particularly drinking water contaminants. She has also served as a member of several advisory and peer review committees for governmental agencies. She has also taught award-winning courses in environmental epidemiology and reproductive epidemiology and has co-authored the best-selling textbook, Essentials of Epidemiology in Public Health. Dr. Aschengrau, I now turn the program over to you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hengel, and welcome everyone to my talk on the neurotoxic effects of early life exposure to tetrachloroethylene contaminated drinking water. I'm on slide 3, and I'm just about to move to slide 4, the overview of my presentation. So I'll be telling you about PCE's uses and fate, as well as how PCE contaminated Cape Cod's drinking water. Cape Cod, Massachusetts is the site of our research. I'll also be describing our birth study cohort methods and some results from the cohort. The particular results that I will be focusing on today are what we call risky behaviors, smoking, cigarettes, alcoholic beverage consumption, and illicit drug use, as well as mental illness, depression, bipolar disorder, PTSD, and schizophrenia. Now for slide 5. So PCE stands for tetrachloroethylene. You can see a diagram of the molecule in the upper left-hand corner. So it's a very simple molecule, 2 carbon atoms joined by a double bond, and 4 chlorine atoms attached. And so trichloroethylene is the chemical that is known by the abbreviation TCE, and so tetrachloroethylene is known by the abbreviation PCE. It's also known as PERC. It's a very important solvent from a commercial standpoint. It's used for dry cleaning, textile processing, and metal degreasing. In fact, it's still the most widely used dry cleaning solvent in the United States. It's estimated that about 650 people in the U.S. are exposed to PCE through their work, and this work tends to occur in small, geographically dispersed, and poorly controlled facilities, such as dry cleaners, garages, and machine shops, and is the result of fugitive emissions and improper industrial disposal. PCE is a fairly common drinking water contaminant. Various surveys have been conducted over the years, and the prevalence of PCE contamination in these surveys has ranged from 8 to 38%. The Environmental Working Group collects data from water utilities around the country, and they have reported that there are 117 water utilities in 27 states that serve 5 million people with levels above the current legal limit. Now for slide 6. So while improper industrial disposal is the typical way that PCE contaminates most drinking water supplies, this wasn't the way that it contaminated the water supplies of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. In 1980, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection discovered that PCE was leaching into the drinking water from a vinyl liner that was placed in the water distribution pipes. The vinyl liner had been introduced in 1968 in response to complaints about the taste and odor of the water. The liner had been applied in a slurry that was sprayed onto the inner pipe surface, and the slurry was a combination of 30% vinyl toluene resin and 70% PCE. In other words, the PCE was the solvent for the vinyl toluene resin. And it was assumed that the PCE would disappear in the curing process, which really was amount to a drying process, but it turned out that substantial quantities remained and leached into the drinking water supply. Slide 7. Now, when the problem was discovered in 1980, an investigation occurred as to where the pipes were located and to what extent these pipes were used in Massachusetts and other parts of New England. It turns out that the pipes were used in all six New England states, but about, I think, 50% of the pipes had been installed in Massachusetts. And so over a period of time, the investigation found that there was 660 miles of the vinyl line pipe installed in 91 communities in Massachusetts. And the installation had occurred over about a 12-year period, starting in 1968 all the way through the beginning of 1980. And it turned out that 24% of the pipe that was installed on Cape Cod, that was installed in Massachusetts, had been installed on Cape Cod. If you can see the map in the upper right-hand corner, for those of you who aren't familiar with Massachusetts, Cape Cod is the hook-shaped peninsula in the southeast portion of the state. And it's a very beautiful area, and people, you know, go there to retire and go there for vacations. There were 9 towns on the Cape that had installed the vinyl-lined asbestos cement pipes. And I've given you the amount of miles in each town. So some of the towns had very little pipe installed. For example, Harwich, it was 0.2 miles. Whereas the town of Falmouth had 50 miles of the pipe installed. And you might ask why so much pipe was installed in this area. It was just because these towns were undergoing a lot of population growth during these years. New neighborhoods were being built, and they were bringing in, you know, a water supply. And because people had been complaining about the taste and odor of the water, when the lining had not been used, they installed the pipes with this lining. Also part of the investigation about the extent of the problem involved taking samples. And so the Department of Environmental Protection went to various locations all around the Cape and found some quite high levels in low-flow locations from 1,600 to 7,750 micrograms per liter. So these would be areas where it might be like the end of a dead-end street, for example, or the levels in many other areas were much lower, from 1.5 to 80 micrograms per liter in these medium or high flow locations, sort of more on a main street. Next slide. And so this slide shows you one of the original maps of the vinyl-lined water pipes that we obtained from the local drinking water companies. And so, you know, you can see there are these lines that are highlighted in yellow, and those are the areas where the vinyl-lined pipe was installed. There are other areas which you really can't see very well in this that are not highlighted in yellow, where the pipes were not installed. And also on these maps, I don't know if you can make it out, it's kind of faint, they have the installation year as well as information about the pipe, like the diameter. Next slide. So needless to say, there was a lot of publicity when the DEP finally put two and two together, and it actually took quite a number of years for them to figure out that the vinyl liner was the source of this contamination. And the Boston Globe, which is, you know, the main newspaper in Boston, even at that time, broke the story to the public, and the headline read, "Pipes Pollute Some New England Water." And a quote from that original article stated, "Environmental officials disclosed that water flowing into thousands of New England homes was contaminated with a chemical suspected of being a cancer-causing agent." Now remember, this is 1980, so it's long before our current IARC rating for PCE that states PCE is probably carcinogenic, or the NTP classification, current classification for PCE, which states that it's reasonably anticipated to be carcinogenic. But needless to say, this was very concerning to everyone, and so action needed to be taken. Next slide. So the official response in 1980 was aided by the EPA, who issued an action level of 40 micrograms per liter. They also recommended that individuals boil their water, purchase bottled water, and this is, you know, way before the time of common bottled water use. That they install activated carbon filters, that the towns remove and replace the pipes, that they reline the pipes with cement mortar. And the last, which was actually the one that was used most commonly, was to install bleeder taps to flush the lines. In other words, to flush a lot of water through the lines to dissolve the PCE before it entered the water supply. The other methods, you know, removing and replacing the pipe, relining the pipes with cement mortar, were really just impractical given the extent of the pipes across Massachusetts. And then, as I mentioned, also during this time, there were lots and lots of water samples that were taken to determine the extent of the contamination and also monitor the success of the remediation. Next slide. So from the first year that the pipes were installed, so 1968 through the early 1980, there were, though, thousands of Massachusetts residents that were exposed to PCE contaminated drinking water for various periods of time, all depending on when the particular pipe had been installed in their neighborhood and let's say when they moved into that neighborhood. Based on our early work, we estimated that about 15% of the Cape Cod population had some exposure. And of course, the levels before 1980 may have been quite high. And even in 1980, and as they conducted the remediation, remember the action level was 40 parts per billion. And so once they hit 40, they thought that they were done. And I'm sure that you know that this is 8 times the current MCL of 5 micrograms per liter. Next slide. So here is a map of the part of Cape Cod, and it's a map from our geographic information system. We used the data and those early maps that we received from the Department of Environmental Protection and the local water companies to create maps like this. And so you see the vinyl line pipes in red, and the unlined pipes in blue. And so from an epidemiologist standpoint, it's a unique exposure scenario, and there are good parts to it and not so good parts to it from an epidemiologist standpoint, someone who is wanting to do research in this area. And so good thing and also a bad thing is the irregular pattern of contamination with no point source. And so this irregular pattern of contamination is actually good from an epidemiologist standpoint of confounding, in that really next door neighbors can have very different exposure levels, and it really all depends on the way the water is flowing through the pipe. The irregular pattern of contamination without having a point source, though, makes the exposure assessment somewhat challenging. Another unique aspect of this exposure scenario has to do with a wide range of exposure levels, and this is a very good thing for an epidemiologist who is trying to look at health effects and wants to have enough power to be able to detect a health effect, to have people who are exposed to very high levels and people with more moderate exposures, as well as people with lower exposures. The other thing that's unique that also has to do with the irregular pattern of contamination partly is that there's little confounding by other water contaminants. So on the Cape there's been various concerns about other drinking water contaminants, for example, contaminants that were emanating from the large military reservation that's on Cape Cod. But it turns out that the pattern of those contaminants does not follow the pattern of contaminants with PCE. And so even if they are present, they don't confound the associations that we might look for with PCE. Other challenging things about the exposure assessment has to do with the fact that there's no sampling data prior to 1980 when they discovered the contamination, as well as the fact that remediation occurred upon discovery, albeit the remediation occurred only to the level of 40 parts per billion, but it still was some remediation. Next slide, on slide 13. So our research, our team at BU has been examining the health effects of PCE contaminated drinking water for probably about 15 or more years. And we've been trying to use this natural experiment to learn about the health effects among individuals who are exposed as adults as well as in early life. And our early work had to do with our carcinogenicity in relation to adult exposure, and we published the results of a number of case control studies looking at various cancers in relation to PCE exposure. And then we became interested in early life exposure and began to look at reproductive and developmental effects in this birth cohort, as well as most recently examined the neurotoxic effects of PCE exposure, my topic for today. So just a little bit about the neurotoxicity of PCE. There is abundant animal and human evidence that supports a wide range of effects on neurologic function for both acute and chronic exposure. Acute exposures lead to headache, dizziness, confusion, nausea, eye irritation. Very, very high exposures may lead to unconsciousness and even death from respiratory depression. And chronic exposures have been associated with numerous neurological impairments, such as impairments in memory, cognition, attention, also mood changes, including anxiety and depression, as well as vision problems. Now, most of the research, human research, that has been conducted on PCE has been conducted on occupationally exposed adults, And so there's very little information that's been published on early life exposure. And early life exposure is a concern. PCE is a small molecule. It crosses the placenta. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. And it has a high affinity for lipophilic tissues. And it's also been shown to be present in breast milk. Next slide. So the purpose of our study, which is called the Cape Cod Health Study, was to try to begin to fill this gap in the literature. And the study design that we used is a retrospective cohort study. And our aim was to look at the long-term neurotoxic effects of early life exposure. And so our source population were children born from 1969 to 1983 to women who lived in Cape Cod towns with some vinyl-lined asbestos cement pipe. And we identified the subjects by cross-matching the maternal addresses that were written on the birth certificates with information from the water companies on the location and the installation year of the vinyl-lined asbestos cement pipes. Our initial, next slide, number 16. Our initial exposure assessment was based on a visual inspection of the maps depicting the pipe distribution network in the immediate vicinity of the birth addresses. So we were basically looking at who had a birth residence that was adjacent to a vinyl-lined asbestos cement pipe. And by doing this cross-matching with the information on the birth record, we identified 1,910 births. And we selected a group of unexposed subjects randomly from the remaining resident births, and we frequency matched on a month and year of birth to the exposed subjects, and we had 1,928 unexposed subjects. There were a few twins. That's why the numbers aren't exactly identical. Next slide, number 17. We also decided to include the older siblings of these this initial group of exposed and unexposed subjects. So the older siblings were also selected if they were born in Massachusetts during the exposure period. And we found a little over 1,200. And the older sibs were initially considered unexposed because they were born before the family moved to an affected Cape Cod residence. But I will tell you that this initial exposure assessment was only considered provisional until we did a much more extensive assessment. The next slide, now number 18. And so our extensive assessment to assess PCE exposure used a leaching and transport model to estimate the mass of PCE that was delivered to each residence from the prenatal period through the age of 5 years. Our model estimated the quantity, and this model actually was originally developed by Helena Brown and Tom Webler, who were at Clark University at the time. Our model estimated the quantity of PCE that was entering the water using information on the initial quantity of the PCE in the liner, and this was estimated using the pipe length and the diameter, as well as the age of the pipe and the leaching rate of PCE from the liner into the water. And this model gave us what we called a relative delivered dose. It was an ordinal estimate of exposure. Next slide. And so here is just a graph showing you the leaching rate of PCE. This work was done by an MIT graduate student. There were laboratory experiments that she conducted. Avery DeMond was her name. And she determined that the leaching rate from the liner into the water followed a simple exponential decay relationship with a rate constant of 2.25 years. And you can see that the amount of PCE remaining in a pipe actually drops off very quickly. And so if you happen to live adjacent to a lined pipe, right when it's installed, your exposure will be much higher than, say, if you moved there just 2 or 3 years later. Your exposure would be much lower. Next slide. Now, a very important determinant of someone's exposure has to do with the water flow. And the water flow rate and the direction are functions of the pipe configuration as well as the number of users. So here you see a map, and it shows some land parcels as well as the lined pipe, which is in red, and the unlined pipe, which is in blue. And you have two squares there in yellow that show a hypothetical subject residence. And so so let's take the residence that is in the upper right-hand corner. If the water is flowing downward from the black arrow to the residence, then that particular home and the individuals living in that home would not be exposed to PCE. Whereas if it were flowing in the other direction, following that red arrow upward, that individual would be exposed to PCE. And so, again, the flow direction and magnitude also, they're both so important. And being so important, there also were very, very difficult to figure out given the complex configuration of the pipes in many areas. Next slide. And so our birth cohort study, not our early work, but our birth cohort study used EPANet software to model water flow and direction. And so we incorporated the leaching and transport algorithm that was developed by Webler and Brown into the EPA software. And the EPA software had been originally developed to help water utilities design water monitoring programs, but the software has been very useful in several other epidemiological studies. And one of the wonderful things about it is that it has an open source code that enables someone like me to be able to incorporate my leaching and transport algorithm. Next slide. So the here's that map again showing the vinyl-lined asbestos cement pipes as well as the unlined pipes. And you see an area that's outlined in a dot, a blue dashed square. In our very early work, we really were just assessing exposure in that small area and estimating whether we thought someone was exposed or unexposed. But the EPANet software really enabled us to take the entire water distribution into account, and as well as these really complex geometries where we would really have difficulty in the past trying to figure out, well, which way was the water flowing. Next slide. And so this is kind of a long story made short. It really is like many years of work to figure to actually figure out the PCE exposures for the individuals in our study population. So here is a schematic showing the water distribution system in an area, and you'll see the dots in blue show lower RDD levels, where the dots in red show higher RDD levels. And these dots are we call them nodes, and they're points of consumption. And we linked these nodes to residences, and so we assigned an exposure to a residence for every year of their residence at that particular address. Next slide. So here is some information about our study population. We ended up with 1,512 people who we were able to trace and who responded to our questionnaire. And across the top it has initial exposure status. So those were our tentative exposure designations, just based on the visual inspection of the maternal address at the birth in relation to the pipes. And then our final exposure status on along the left-hand column, which was the status after this extensive exposure assessment. And you can see that some people changed their initial exposure status, and most of them were unexposed subjects who ended up having some exposure. And so it turned out that they were further downstream from a vinyl-lined pipe than we originally considered exposed. But they were exposed, according to our improved model. The model indicated a different flow direction than was first thought. Next slide. And so here are some characteristics of the study population. Along the top, we have the group that had both prenatal and early childhood exposure. And we were really unable to separate out prenatal exposure from early childhood exposure because most people had both, as well as along the top, the unexposed subjects. So you can see that, you know, when we contacted them, it was, say about 2004 or 5. They were, on average, about 29 years old, and almost 40% were male. Now, that meant really was a reflection of the fact that the females tended to respond more commonly than the male subjects in our study. Like the rest of Cape Cod, the study population was by and large white. Most of these individuals were college educated. Nearly all of their mothers received prenatal care. We also obtained information on various maternal habits. So these are, you know, the kids' mothers, what they did during pregnancy. Some smoked cigarettes, so it was about very similar for the exposed and unexposed subjects. Alcoholic beverage consumption was a little bit more common, about 36%. There were some women who admitted to smoking marijuana during the gestation, only about 3%. We also collected a lot of information about the subjects themselves, their possible exposure to solvents. So I've only given you one item here on the graph, on the chart, the subjects who ever had a job that might involve solvent exposure. So by and large, this, you know, is a middle-class population, and let's go on to the next slide. So we decided to take a very broad view of what neurotoxic exposures, neurotoxic outcomes might result from this exposure. And so we decided to look at risky behaviors. The prior studies on cognition and behavior and mood seem to indicate that it was, that these behaviors could result, also result from PCE exposure. So these were self-administered questionnaires that the subjects returned to us, and the questions asked about ever being a regular smoker, the age at initiation of smoking, as well as smoking frequency and amount, if they ever consumed alcoholic beverages, the age at initiation of drinking, and drinking frequency, both as a teen and an adult, and a whole series of questions about drug use, ever use of marijuana, inhalants, cocaine, psychedelics, club drugs, both as a teenager and as an adult. Next slide. And so here are our results for smoking. And so you should notice that we divided the study population into four groups. So there, and look under the column exposure percentile. So there's a group with no exposure. And then among the exposed, we divided the subjects into tertiles. So greater than the 67th percentile is the top third of the exposure distribution. And so you are given the percent of subjects who said yes in each of these categories, as well as the GEE risk ratio. So, you know, a null risk ratio would be 1.0, and the GEE risk ratio was calculated because, so it's GEE stands for generalized estimating equations. It was calculated because that there were several kids often from the same family, and so they weren't quite independent observations for, you know, all of the variables that we were looking at. So so our statistician felt that we needed to use that particular statistical model. Also, I should note that we assessed many, many confounders in our analyses, but none changed the crude risk ratios by at least 10%. And so what I am giving you in the last column are the crude risk ratios. Okay, so that being said, so here are the results for smoking. So ever smoked, we see just a hint of a tiny increase among the individuals most highly exposed. The GE risk ratio is 1.2. Smoked more than 20 cigarettes a day. Again, there's just this tiny suggestion of an increase among the most highly exposed. The risk ratio is 1.3. Next slide. This slide shows similar setup for the results, only they're the results for alcohol consumption. And here is the data for the initiation of early alcohol consumption. First drank less than or equal to 13 years of age. Again, a really tiny hint of something going on in the uppermost category. And for drinking more than 8 days a month as a teen, there was a larger increase for this uppermost exposure percentile, a GEE risk ratio of 1.6. Moving on to the next slide for drug use. Here are the results for using two or more major drugs as a teen or two or more major drugs as an adult. And major drugs included all of the drugs that I listed except for marijuana. I should tell you that the results for marijuana were completely null. And really what we saw associations, and they were for these major drugs. And so here you see, again, that there is an increase for the most highly exposed individuals. So there's a GEE risk ratio of 1.6 that's statistically stable, and also a GEE risk ratio of 1.5 that's statistically stable for the adults. So this is two or more major drugs. And we did lots and lots of analyses on this. Next slide, number 30. We examined the specific drugs for which increases were observed, and we saw increases for crack and cocaine as a teen. I'm just sort of giving you a smattering of results. Crack and cocaine as a teen, psychedelics and hallucinogens as a teen, club and designer drugs as an adult, Ritalin without a prescription as an adult. And we actually saw similar, so crack and cocaine was also elevated for adult use. Club and designer drugs were also elevated for teen use. So again, I'm in the interest of time, I'm just picking out some results here and there to show you. Now, one of the things, next slide, number 31, one of the things we were concerned about was possible confounding by the exposure, other exposures that may have occurred in utero, right? So remember, we asked the mother whether or not she smoked cigarettes during her pregnancy, or whether she drank any alcoholic beverages or smoked marijuana during pregnancy. We actually didn't ask the mothers about any other drugs, just marijuana. And so what we did was repeat the analyses, excluding subjects whose mother had this history. In other words, we looked at subjects whose mothers did not do any of these things during pregnancy. And we found that the associations actually grew stronger. So here are the results for two or more major drugs as a teen. And just look at the top column for the most highly exposed in the highest tertile of exposure. The GEE risk ratio was 2.3, was statistically stable. The same thing for two or more major drugs as an adult, 2.1. Again, we did lots of analyses. One of the things that we were interested in was to see whether the teen users went on to be adult users of drugs, and they, I think about 75% of them did. So there is overlap between these data that I'm showing you. They're not all, you know, separate individuals only doing things during the teen years or only doing things during the adult years. So our next slide, number 32, our results suggest that the occurrence of risky behaviors, particularly drug use, is increased among adults with high PCE exposure levels during gestation and early childhood. And this, these findings were recently published in the online journal Environmental Health. They were published just last December, and I think that we'll be able to make the article available to everyone as part of this webinar. Now I just want to move on to the findings for mental illness. So next slide, number 33. On our questionnaire, we asked, has a doctor or healthcare provider ever said that you had, and asked about depression, schizophrenia, bipolar or manic depressive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And if yes, we obtained the year of diagnosis. And for everyone, we also obtained information on family history of these disorders. Next slide. And so here are the results for mental illness. We really did not find an association for depression. See, the risk ratios are all very close to the null. There are no trends there with increasing exposure. We found, though, that bipolar disorder was increased in the most highly exposed individuals. The risk ratio was 2.7, and it was statistically stable. We assessed many confounders and didn't find that any changed the crude risk ratio by at least 10%. And then the next slide, post-traumatic stress disorder also seemed to be increased among the most highly exposed individuals. The risk ratio was 1.7. And schizophrenia, now we only had 4 cases of schizophrenia that were reported in our study population. And while 3 of the 4 were exposed, you can see the N's in the table, we really didn't believe that we had enough information to be able to make any statements about the increased risk of schizophrenia. Next slide. So these results also suggest that the risks of bipolar disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder are increased among adults with high PCE exposure levels during gestation and early childhood. And they suggest that depression is not related to early life exposure. These results were also published recently, that was the following month, in the online journal Environmental Health, and again we'll make them available to the webinar participants. Next slide. So as an epidemiologist, I would be greatly remiss if I didn't discuss at length the study limitations. And I think that it's important to realize that the data on the risky behaviors and the mental illnesses are self-reported, and so we worry about people not reporting these illnesses and these behaviors, and we could certainly understand why they would not report them. And so it was important to us to see how our prevalence data for the risky behaviors and the mental illnesses compared to, say, other surveys. And we actually found there are some other independent surveys that have been conducted on Cape Cod and throughout Massachusetts, and we found that the prevalence of the risky behaviors, including the drug use, was very similar or even higher than those in the independent surveys. And in other words, so our reporting rates were similar or higher than those in these other surveys. Although the prevalence of mental illness in our study population was lower than some other surveys. For example, a national survey of various mental illnesses, and they asked about the lifetime prevalence of illnesses among a group of 30 to 44-year-olds, and they found that the prevalence of depression was 22.7%, whereas we found a prevalence of 17.5%. So it's definitely we're getting some lower reporting, especially for the mental illnesses, although it doesn't seem to be the case for the risky behaviors, not at least to as great a degree. The other study limitation was the low response rate. So among the, we had 40% of the subjects that were successfully traced actually responded to the survey. And I will say it's not like in the old days when I was doing this kind of research where we would be getting response rates of 70 or 80%. It's just something that's been becoming a problem for all epidemiologists conducting this type of research, that the response rates have been just dropping in the last 10 or so years. And so this has a two-pronged problem. One is that it makes the effective sample size smaller, and so you have less power to detect an effect. And then, of course, you worry about the people who responded compared to the ones who didn't respond. You worry about selection bias and whether or not that, you know, your results could be biased as a result of a low response rate. So one of the nice things about our study is that we did have some information on the people who didn't respond. It was that original information that we got from the birth records, as well as our initial exposure assessment. And when we compared the characteristics, available characteristics of the respondents and non-respondents, we did not find any differences that would lead us to believe that there was selection bias. Another study limitation is residual confounding by unmeasured variables. There were lots of potential confounders for which we did not have data. For example, for the drug use, you would want to know about parental supervision, social support, peer influences. We did not have information on that. And then the last study limitation is exposure misclassification. Even though we made all of these improvements in our exposure assessment, we still believe that there was exposure misclassification. Because we did not have good recall from the mothers about the bathing habits and water consumption patterns that occurred during this period, we couldn't incorporate that information into our exposure assessment. And so what we're really basically getting is an assessment of the PCE that entered the home without really taking into account the behavioral characteristics that occur among the residents in the home. Next slide. One of the things that we were able to look at, though, we conducted a couple of validation studies where we went back to the reports of those samples that were taken when the water contamination was discovered in 1980. And we compared those sample results, so the concentrations of PCE in those samples, with our modeled estimated concentrations. And we saw that for an epidemiological study that there was reasonable agreement between the two. Here's a scatter plot showing the data, and the Spearman correlation coefficient was 0.65, and it was statistically significant. So it wasn't too bad, so we were reassured. We did this validation study without using EPANET, and then again with using EPANET, and we found that the correlations improved with EPANET, and so we thought that EPANET was a definite improvement in our exposure assessments. Next slide. So let's just put the findings into some context. As far as I know, there have been no prior studies looking at the relationship between solvent exposure in early life and risky behaviors. The prior studies of neurotoxic effects among individuals with early life exposure have produced mixed results, and these studies have looked mainly at learning, attention, and behavior in young children. Four of the studies found no association, two found some lower scores among exposed children. These children tended to have parents who worked, mothers who worked with solvents. And so the literature is mixed, and yet it doesn't really give us any data really to be able to assess maybe these long-term effects. There was only one study that I was able to identify that looked at the risk of schizophrenia in the offspring of men and women who worked in dry cleaning operations. This was a record linkage study in Israel. It also included only a handful of schizophrenic cases, and they also happened to find a positive association. So next slide. So needless to say, these studies are very provocative, and they need to be corroborated. I've been trying to think about what might be other suitable populations for long-term study, And I would be most grateful if anyone could help me in this area. I would like to have another population examined in another geographic area to see whether or not we see similar findings. And I think that it's important to continue along this line of research because TCE remains a commercially ubiquitous solvent and a common drinking water contaminant. And it's very important to determine its impact on the health of vulnerable populations. So I'd just like to close by thanking my collaborators who are pictured here, Dave Ozanoff, Tom Webster, Michael Winter, Veronica Vieira, Janice Weinberg, Tricia Janowitz, Lisa Gallagher, Megan Romano, and Bobby White. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Ashton Grau. That was a terrific presentation. So what I propose to do is move right on to the next presentation and hold all the questions till the end. So our second presentation today is going to be a joint presentation from two Superfund-funded researchers, Dr. Rita LaCaruso and Dr. John Meeker. So Dr. Rita LaCaruso is a toxicologist with a research focus in female reproductive toxicology, and in particular, mechanisms related to adverse pregnancy outcomes, such as premature birth. She has her primary appointment as professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences at the University of Michigan, where she's the leader of the toxicology program, director of the NIEHS-sponsored training grant for environmental toxicology and epidemiology program, and leader of the oxidative stress research team in the NIEHS-sponsored Center for Life Stage Exposures and Adult Disease. So Dr. John Meeker is Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. His work focuses on defining sources, magnitudes, and consequences of human exposure to environmental and occupational contaminants, with a special interest in reproductive and developmental effects associated with endocrine-disrupting chemicals. Dr. Meeker has an MS in environmental science from Harvard and a PhD and a doctor of science in exposure assessment with a minor in biostatistics and environmental and occupational epidemiology. Okay, so I turn the presentation over to the both of you, and I guess we're going to start with Dr. Rita LaCaruso.
Yes, hi. Hello, everybody out there. Thank you for tuning in, for dialing in for this Clue-In seminar. Thank you, Jerry, for that kind introduction. And thank you to Justin Crane, who did the logistics for this Clue-In seminar. I have to say he was very patient with us and effective. Finally, I want to thank Heather Henry. And Heather is the project officer for the Superfund Research Program Center that sponsors the research that we're going to discuss today. That is the PROTECT Center, which is a collaboration between three institutions. It's based out of Northeastern University in Boston, includes the University of Michigan, where John and I are from, as well as scientists from the University of Puerto Rico. And as the title of our talk says, this is a multidisciplinary approach, and you heard from the introductions that John and I come from different disciplines. I'm primarily a toxicologist. I'm interested in how and why things happen. How and why do these environmental contaminants modify physiologic processes to bring about dysfunction or disease? And John has his profession in the environmental exposure and environmental epidemiology fields, where he is interested in studying human populations for these outcomes. And what we're finding is that by working together and feeding each other ideas and information from our various approaches, that we actually come up and generate some new ideas that we hope will help move the field forward. Okay, so the other thing in our talk I need to touch on is that we're going to be talking about phthalates, and we forgot kind of to put a slide in there about phthalates. So let me just tell you that phthalates are a ubiquitous environmental contaminant. The CDC NHANES biomonitoring study does in fact detect phthalates in the urines of most of the samples of this cross-sectional study cohort in the U.S. population. And that because phthalates have a relatively short half-life, what that says is that exposure to these chemicals is probably fairly continuous. And where do we find these phthalates and how do we get exposed? Well, the significant use of these phthalates is the use of the diethylhexyl phthalate, or DEHP, as a plasticizer in polyvinyl chloride products. In addition, some of the phthalates are used in pharmaceuticals, as well as fragrance stabilizers in personal care products like shampoos and perfumes and colognes. So that's slide 42. I guess I should have announced that first. And now moving to slide 43. One of the reasons why we became focused on preterm birth as an adverse outcome is because preterm birth rates have been increasing over the past several decades. And this slide shows the change in the rates of preterm birth in the U.S. population from 1990 to 2006. And you can see that preterm births as well as low birth weights have been going up. While there appears to be a leveling off just in the very last couple of years, still it remains that about 1 in 8 live births in the United States are born preterm. A preterm birth is defined operationally as a baby that is born before 37 completed weeks of gestation. So next slide, slide 44. And the other reason why we're interested in preterm birth is because preterm birth has consequences. One of those consequences is economics. So there was a study published on 2003 data that indicated that hospital costs for a preterm or low birth weight infant averaged about $77,000 compared with $1,700 for a term infant. In addition, that preterm infants accounted for about half of hospital charges for all infants, with the annual U.S. medical costs of reaching approximately $26 billion. So it's a huge societal cost, as well as personal cost in terms of economics. And in addition, there are psychological costs. It's documented that parents of preterm birth infants suffer increased symptoms of depression, stress, and even post-traumatic stress disorder. It is no easy task to be a parent of a preterm birth baby. Next slide, slide 45. In addition to those psychological and economic costs, there are significant medical consequences for a baby being born too soon. First and foremost, preterm birth is now considered the leading cause of infant death, with about 20% of infant deaths attributed to preterm births. And preterm birth babies being born preterm is associated with or accompanied by a whole host of medical complications. And I list some of them here, some of the most predominant ones, and I will mention some of those most predominant ones. These include respiratory distress syndrome, bleeding in the brain, which is clinically called intraventricular hemorrhage. In addition, congenital neurological defects, about half of which are attributed or associated with preterm birth. This is things like cerebral palsy. Chronic lung disease, such as bronchopulmonary dysplasia. In addition, other consequences like apnea, increased risk for apnea, retinopathy of prematurity, anemia, and infections can occur. So just in considering this sequelae of consequences for preterm birth, it is, I hope, easy to understand the premise of our research, that any environmental exposures that contribute to an increased risk for preterm birth increase the potential for adverse lifelong long-term consequences for the offspring. So I'm going to hand it now over to my colleague, John Meeker.
Thank you, Rita. I'm going to take it from here for a little while and go to slide 46. So on slide 46, we show the green line at the bottom there is the, or in the middle, is showing the curve that Dr. LaCrusoe showed a few slides ago, the USA rates increasing since 1990. The black line, however, shows that the rates in Puerto Rico are increasing at a much more rapid rate through the 1990s and early part of the this millennium to almost one out of every five births are now preterm in Puerto Rico. So they've done some exploration of this, and they found that none of the well-known predictors of preterm birth are risk factors, such as maternal age, education, smoking, IVF or other assisted reproductive technologies, other clinical factors like C-section. None of those things really explain this increase. So there's the thought that there may be some environmental role in this increased rate. On to slide 47. So I mentioned Puerto Rico, and that is, of course, the site of our program. It is, as many of you I'm sure are aware, it's a beautiful Caribbean island. It's got a lot of different natural beauty involving beaches, mountains, rainforests. However, it does have, especially in the past 100 years, a history of a lot of military and industrial activity, which has led to quite a bit of environmental contamination. If you look at the figure in the lower right-hand corner, this picture shows nearly 200 different hazardous waste sites. Many of these are unlined landfills, and 15 of them are on the national priorities list. And these are typically, or for the most part, concentrated in the shaded regions in the north coast and in the south. The shaded areas represent the karstic geology in these regions, which means it has high mobility in the caves for reaching groundwater contaminants once they get reach this geology, as well as a lot of permeability in the limestone. So when you combine the high level of pollution, the mobility of these contaminants, and the rates of preterm birth, you can hopefully see how our thinking is moving along as to why we want to investigate environmental factors potentially associated with preterm birth. On to slide 48. So there is evidence for contamination of a range of chemicals in Puerto Rico, but why did we choose phthalates for this talk and for some of our research in this program? This slide is showing just a portion of that north coast. There's not a ton of data available. This is from historical data showing the red dots on the left-hand figure are Superfund sites, or National Priorities List sites. And you can see around those are some brown dots. Those are samples of wells and other groundwater samples looking at phthalates, and those are sites with detectable levels of phthalates in the water. So we further considered phthalates in addition to chlorinated solvents such as TCE and others. But on to slide 49 to continue on this line of phthalates. So there is some evidence out there of human pregnancy outcomes in association with phthalate exposure. The first coming from Latini et al. In 2003, they looked at the metabolite of DEHP, which is diethylhexyl phthalate, the one that Rita mentioned is used in flexible PVC products. That was inversely associated with gestation age or gestation length in an Italian study. And then Robin Wyatt and colleagues at Columbia did another study along those lines, only they measured it in urine, the DEHP metabolites, and found a similar thing in that those with highest MEP concentrations in urine delivered on average 5 days earlier than those in the lowest quartile. Beyond that, there is a Chinese study showing increased odds for low birth weight in association with metabolites of DEHP and dibutyl phthalate. So that's another one. And then on the flip side, conversely, there's been two recent studies from Mary Wolf's group at Mount Sinai showing no association or even a positive association between DEHP metabolites and gestation length. And then Shauna Swan's group as well found that a similar finding. So it must be noted here that there are a lot of differences in the populations that have been studied to date. Very low proportion of preterm births in most of these studies relative to the national average. So you might expect 12% preterm births in a study in this country. These studies were well below that. So some of these issues may help explain why the results have been so inconsistent. I also wanted to mention briefly a study from 2000 that was in Environmental Health Perspectives by Colon et al. This was a study of premature breast development in Puerto Rico, and it did suggest elevated concentrations of phthalates in that study. However, because they measured the parent compounds in blood, there is some uncertainty as to the validity of those measures. So as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any additional exposure data out of Puerto Rico on phthalates since then. Okay, moving on to slide 50. So with all this information, Rita and I were able to secure some pilot funding through what then became our NIEHS P30 Center to look at this potential relationship in a nested case control study. So building off of Howard Hu's cohort in Mexico City area, we took 30 preterm births and compared with 30 term births and measured third trimester phthalate concentrations and found significant differences in these concentrations where for a number of phthalate metabolites, concentrations were significantly higher among the preterm, the women who eventually delivered preterm compared to those delivering at term. This was for the DEHP metabolites and especially for the metabolite of dibutyl phthalate, MBP there in the first row. You can see it's nearly three times greater median level among the preterm births. So with that, slide 51, I'll explain briefly a little bit about our center. So this led to our Superfund Program Center, and we have, as Dr. LaCruz mentioned, a very multidisciplinary approach here to this core theme of contamination and preterm birth in Puerto Rico. So Project 1 is a non-targeted analysis by a biochemist and analytical chemist named Roger Giese at Northeastern. So he's doing some very highly sensitive, state-of-the-art chemistry analysis to look for peaks and other things that may not be picked up on conventional exposure assessments. Rita is leading Project 2, that's the experimental biomedical projects. I'm leading Project 3, epidemiology. Project 4 is a fate and transport study being led by Dr. Ingrid Padilla at University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez. And then Project 5 is a green remediation project that's led by Dr. Akram Al-Shawabki at Northeastern, who is also the overall PI of the program. Helping him as a co-leader of the program is Dr. Jose Cordero. He is the Dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Puerto Rico. And I should also mention our research cores. So we have Core C is called the Human Subjects and Sampling Core. That's being conducted by Dr. Cordero and his team down in Puerto Rico, which includes Braulio Jimenez, who is a toxicologist in the biochemistry department. And then we have Core D, which is run by David Kelly up at Northeastern, and they're going to be handling this massive amount of data that we're going to be generating through all these projects and able to link them as needed to work towards this issue. And finally, we have a research translation core and a training core led by Michael Silovich and Tom Sheehan, respectively. They are both in the engineering school at Northeastern. On to slide 52. So as leader of the epidemiology project, I can tell you that recruitment is in full gear at this point, even though we're just coming up on the end of our second year of the study. Our goal is to recruit 800 to 850 women in our initial funding cycle. And we're up above 200 at this point. And you can see with this map, we're showing the current recruitment sites. We've expanded a little bit since the beginning, but we're up to these sites. You can see how they're focused on the northern coast. And we have three partnering hospitals in Manatee and Arecibo where these prenatal clinics, the women typically tend to ultimately deliver. So this is a map of where we're recruiting. So we're going to have some good geographic distribution in this North Coast area, as well as some groundwater sampling through Project 4 and some other things to help link the environmental or the non-bio to the bio projects. On to slide 53. Since recruitment is ongoing, we have sent several batches of samples to the lab. We don't have that data yet, but this slide is just giving you an idea of what it is we're doing with the epidemiology. So early in pregnancy, we recruit participants, look for eligibility and consent. Then in about week 16, we take some vital questionnaire information and collect some urine and blood samples for various things. And then we abstract data from medical records as well. After that, at about week 20, we do an in-home visit where we do a very extensive interview with a nurse or a physician working as part of our core team. And they get a lot of details on occupational history, medical history, things like that. They also collect a tap water sample to try and link with some of the engineering studies. And we hope to start collecting house dust samples in the near future. We also get a urine sample there and a hair sample. Then in the third trimester, late second, early third trimester, we get another clinic visit, which is similar to that V1, the second trimester visit at 16 weeks. But here we also do a food frequency questionnaire. And then finally at delivery, we're working on getting cord and placenta samples as well as birth records and clinical data to link all this for the epidemiology project. So now to slide 54, I'm going to pass it back to Rita LaCruso to describe some of the experimental work going on.
Okay, thanks, John. So as John discussed, phthalates have been associated with preterm birth, including that Mexican cohort study that we did together. And when you go into the literature and start reading about pathways of preterm birth and pathways of activation of parturition or childbirth, what you commonly find is a model or a description of a model similar to what's illustrated on slide 54. And this is taken from a 2009 publication of John Challis. And in this model, it is suggested that it begins with an inflammatory stimulus and that this inflammatory stimulus is usually, well, the inflammatory stimulus that is best documented is a pathogen, bacteria, an infection. And that then these pathogens, acting through toll-like receptors, increase the synthesis and release in the gestational compartment of pro-inflammatory cytokines, things like IL-1 beta, TNF-alpha, IL-8, IL-6, and increase then the synthesis and release of prostaglandins, the synthesis and activation of matrix metalloproteinases, which help to degrade extracellular matrix, and the recruitment to the gestational compartment of white blood cells, such as macrophages and neutrophils, which then amplify the parturition pathway through the additional release of these parturition activation mediators like prostaglandins and pro-inflammatory cytokines. And these mediators, these chemical signals, bring on the changes in the physiology of pregnancy that characterize labor. They stimulate contractions of the uterine muscle or the myometrium so that they become forceful and synchronous. They cause rupture of the gestational membranes. That is the sac that surrounds the fetus in the womb and has to break in order for the fetus to be released from the womb. And cervical ripening, which is the dilation of the cervix, which then allows the fetus to be expelled through the birth canal by the contractions of the myometrium. In most experimental models of parturition, the most common stimulus applied is something called lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. And this is a very highly immunogenic component of many bacterial cell walls. And this LPS, and the thing we found when we started reading about and considering toxicant activation of parturition pathways, we were very interested in the relatively small but growing number of publications that oxidative stress may play a role. In particular, pretreatment or co-treatment with antioxidants will mitigate or block many of the LPS-stimulated responses and will even inhibit LPS-stimulated onset of parturition in mice, which is the animal model, basically, for preterm birth. And so if we go to the next slide, slide 55, this illustrates the hypothesis that we have put forward, that toxicants can activate parturition through an oxidative stress mechanism. This is by no means a widely accepted idea. But as I said earlier, there's a dozen, maybe two dozen now, publications that support this hypothesis. In addition, we're interested in whether toxicants might increase susceptibility for preterm birth through a modification of susceptibility for infection of the gestational compartment, either through acting on the bacteria themselves or by acting on the host response and modifying the host response to the presence of bacteria. So if we go on to slide 56, this illustrates our hypothesis yet a different way. In the red box are chemical stimulants that we have I'm going to talk about today. We suggest that some chemical contaminants, environmental contaminants, will stimulate the cell, illustrated by the blue circle, to produce an increased abundance of so-called reactive oxygen species. That's the ROS in the figure. And these reactive oxygen species can include superoxide anion, hydroxyl ion, hydrogen peroxide, among others, but I've just shown those first three in the cell here. We then propose that these reactive oxygen species act through signal transduction pathways to increase the expression and production of parturition-activating signaling molecules, including prostaglandins and pro-inflammatory cytokines, and in addition that they can activate the apoptotic cell death pathway, which plays a role in the breaking of the membranes, the rupture of the membranes during parturition. Chemicals of interest in the red box on the top include, at the very first one is tert-butyl hydroperoxide, or TBHP. This is not an environmental contaminant. Rather, this is a model prooxidant. We think it's important for us to include a model prooxidant in our work because the oxidative stress mechanism is so new to this field of parturition and preterm birth. And TBHP is a good, we felt, a good model prooxidant because it will diffuse across the cell membrane, and inside the cell it will spontaneously generate reactive oxygen species without requiring any cell response. And so we don't have to worry about whether our cells are capable of this particular pathway or that particular pathway to generate reactive oxygen species. The second compound we've been studying is mono-2-ethylhexylphthalate, or MEHP, and this is a bioactive metabolite of the phthalate diethylhexylphthalate, and that is the phthalate that has been so heavily used in the production of polyvinyl chloride products. A third compound here is not related to phthalates, but it's related to the Superfund project, and that is S12-dichlorovinyl-L-cysteine, or DCVC, and this is a toxic bioactive metabolite of trichloroethylene, which is another Superfund contaminant of interest to our center. Let's see. So we go on now to slide 57, and we are applying various models, and this shows the in vitro models. We also plan to do laboratory rodent in vivo experiments, but right now we're focused on the in vitro models, and they include using a human placental cell line, the HTRSV neo cells, and these are cells that are derived from cytotrophoblasts of human first trimester placentae. In addition, we have more recent work with primary placental macrophages, both of fetal and maternal origin. We also work with tissue pieces from the gestational membranes, which we get from cesarean deliveries here at the University of Michigan hospitals. And some of these experiments, we just do tissue explant cultures where we take a tissue punch and float it in a culture. In others, we mount the tissue on a transwell frame. And transwells, if you're not familiar with it, they're a type of tissue culture system you can use. And there's this frame, which is shown on the far right of slide 57, that frame, normally you buy it with a synthetic membrane on it, and then you invert it in your well, and you put media on the inside and media on the outside, and things can diffuse across that synthetic membrane. You might put one cell type on the top and one on the bottom. In our case, we get the frames from the manufacturer. They're a gift from Corning without any synthetic membrane, and we stretch the human gestational membranes across that, fasten it with a sterilized dental elastic band, trim the tissue off, and invert it into the well, put media in it, and we basically mimicked the human gestational compartment with a fetal side and a maternal side. And that allows us to do some pretty interesting experiments. So those are the main models that we're working with. And now, let's move to slide 58. Now, we've been collecting data, and the data are very encouraging and are supporting much of our proposed model. But unfortunately for this seminar, those data are not yet published. And in fact, some of these data are about to be defended in a couple of weeks by one of my students. But I want to just summarize some of our findings to give you a gist of where we're going and what we're learning. And so with the terbutyl hydroperoxide, Kathy Corte in my laboratory has, demonstrated that it generates the reactive oxygen species as expected, that the generation of ROS is responsible for increased release of cytokines and chemokines from HTRH cells, and an upregulation of PTGS2 gene. That is the gene for the COX-2 or cyclooxygenase 2 enzyme. And that enzyme, its induction is critical for onset of labor for the increased production of prostaglandins. And we also see increased prostaglandin release as well as activation of the apoptotic pathway. What we don't know yet is whether inflammation drives the prostaglandin response or not. And we don't have any data, of course, on parturition. And then with MEHP, this is the phthalate metabolite. This work was done by Lauren Tetz in my laboratory. She's demonstrated that MEHP stimulates in the HTRH cells, reactive oxygen species, and it appears that it's predominantly the hydroxyl radical. She, working with the macrophages from the placentae, she has evidence of leukocyte activation. In all cell types, she has evidence in tissue. She has evidence of increased prostaglandin synthesis, and in several of the models, activation of apoptosis. We have not been able to demonstrate that the reactive oxygen species is stimulating a cytokine release. We don't see that evidence of that. And we don't know yet if the reactive oxygen species is stimulating prostaglandins and apoptosis. We're just in the early stages of our animal work in terms of in vivo effects. And then moving to slide 60 with the DCVC, that is the trichloroethylene metabolite. This is very early work. We really started our emphasis on the phthalates, but what we have so far is very encouraging. We have a very strong cytokine and chemokine release response with this DCVC metabolite, and this is considered the putative, this is the putative toxic metabolite for kidney, which is a significant target organ. We're seeing effects at lower concentrations than are seen in kidney cultures. So we're pretty excited about it, and we also see evidence of activation of the apoptotic cell death pathway. So I'm handing it back to John now. Thank you.
Thanks, Rita. So we'll skip ahead to slide 61. So as I mentioned earlier, we are still heavily recruiting and gaining samples and data for the epidemiology studies. So since that takes a while, we've tried to come up with some creative and new ways to think about other sources of data to test our hypotheses and these potential mechanistic links. And this work is being done in tight conjunction with Rita's project and her team, where we have some of the population-based stuff and the experimental approaches together to inform one another. So I just have a couple slides on some results from NHANES, but since we're running short on time, I'll just go through these very briefly. The National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey is publicly available data from the U.S. It is thought to be representative sample of the population. And so we had two papers written by one of my PhD students, Kelly Ferguson, where we had 8 years of data. We're on a subset of NHANES. They had data for some of these phthalate metabolites in urine, and we were able to look at that in relation to a range of potential markers of inflammation and oxidative stress in blood samples. Because we had so much range of data from 1999 to 2006, some of these comparisons, we had up to 10,000 data points, so a fairly large analysis. So for the first paper, we focused on two of the most commonly used markers. Inflammation, we used C-reactive protein, and oxidative stress, we used gamma-glutamyltransferase, GGT, and we found some interesting associations suggesting increased oxidative stress with the DEHP metabolites, but inflammation was more associated with the other phthalates metabolites. So after talking with Rita's group and sort of talking about this among ourselves and seeing what other people are looking at for oxidative stress and inflammation markers, we after the first paper was published, we went and we decided to dig deeper, and we were able to pull out some more potential markers. So for oxidative stress, we used bilirubin, which is a potent antioxidant. And if you skip to slide 62, we also looked at alkaline phosphatase, absolute neutrophil count, and ferritin, as well as fibrinogen as markers of inflammation. So slide 63, this was a pretty detailed analysis, so I'm just going to highlight some of the findings here on this slide. So that first figure on the left, you can see various phthalate metabolites were strongly associated with decreased bilirubin, which, as I said, that was a potent antioxidant. So that is consistent with the hypothesis of increased oxidative stress. And then I show alkaline phosphatase and absolute neutrophil count in the middle and right-hand side figures, where there was a positive association with a number of metabolites. And again, overall, we're seeing that the oxidative stress was associated with the DEHP metabolites as well as some of the other phthalate metabolites, whereas inflammation was not so much, did not so much appear to be with the DEHP metabolites, but with other phthalates. Slide 64, this is just another analysis we did because thyroid hormones are very important in pregnancy and especially to fetal growth and development. We had a hypothesis based on some previous work we had done that DEHP metabolites and potentially bisphenol A are associated with thyroid hormone levels. So we had 2 years' worth of NHANES data here, and we did find that DEHP metabolites were associated with decreased T4, T3, and thyroglobulin, and suggestive increases with TSH. And we also found some suggestive associations involving bisphenol A, though not quite as strong as for the DEHP metabolites. So on to slide 65 to summarize. We, through this work, phthalates may have a role in preterm birth. Hopefully we described to you that there are experimental and human observational data that that support this potential link and potential mechanistic links as well in the pathway. And these pathways, for example, oxidative stress, it's going to have It may turn out to be important for preterm birth, but it also has many implications for other health effects in other parts of the life stage. And oxidative stress is also not specific to phthalates. It's been shown with many other contaminants as well. So moving into the future, we hope to be able to expand our program to include looking at other contaminants as well as potential later effects in life, not only in relation to preterm birth, but with added follow-up, early life exposures and later health outcomes. And finally, we're showing a picture of our team. This is at one of our meetings in Puerto Rico. Here's most of our investigators. You have Akram and Akram Al-Shawabki and Jose Cordero in the back, the third and fourth from the left. Those are the two, the program leaders. And I say here that multidisciplinarity is needed to address complex environmental health challenges. And what I mean by this is We have engineers, we have physicians, epidemiologists, toxicologists, data people, biostatisticians, all working together, and the team has been working just really, really great together. It's always very energizing to meet with everybody. And so multidisciplinary, but now we're seeing, for example, the work we showed here today, that it's becoming more than multidisciplinary. It's becoming interdisciplinary. And there's signs that in the future, as we continue to move forward, we might be able to achieve transdisciplinary work, where the things that we are able to find may not be defined in one discipline, but can go a long way to helping solve this this public health challenge that we've set out here. So we'd like to thank the NIEHS Superfund Research Program Centers, which really pushes investigators to work with other scientists maybe outside of their own discipline, and to come up with these methods of looking at things in a new way. So thank you.
Before we hand over the floor for questions, I would like to acknowledge, in addition to our faculty collaborators, a shout-out to the fabulous students and staff on our projects. And for my project, this includes Lauren Tetz, Cassie Kollerte, Iman Hassan, Faith Bjork, Adrian Chang, and Kevin Sun. And John, I think for yours, Luis Rivera, Dave Cantonwine, Kelly Ferguson. And if I missed anyone, say it out.
I think that covers it for now. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. You know, it doesn't mean much to those of you out there except for the students. So, and we couldn't do it without them.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rita and John, for a very nice presentation. So before I open the phone lines for questions, I'd appreciate if you just go to the next slide, number 66, and you can see there that you can click on the link to get all kinds of additional resources if you're interested in learning more about these topics. And secondly, don't forget there's a feedback form, and we really would appreciate it if you would fill that out so we can get some feedback on how we're doing on these seminar series. Okay, what I'm going to do now is open for question and answers for all three presenters. So just you can unmute your phone lines and ask a question, and please state who you're directing the question to. And we'll take questions first from the phone lines, and then later I'll go to the questions that came on the Internet. So we'll start with the phone first. So whoever wants to try, go ahead.
Hello?
Sure. Go ahead.
This is a question for Dr. Ashengrau. This is Denise Metzo with Rue Associates. And I'm curious, with your study, I noticed that your unexposed and exposed individuals had similar levels of college graduation. But I'm wondering whether you did any measurements of either high school GPA or any other sorts of measurements, and whether you found any associations between exposure and something that may measure success in education.
We didn't specifically measure GPA, and we have another paper that came out on learning disabilities, though. The lead author is Tricia Janowitz, who received her doctorate at BU, and we didn't find any association with learning disabilities.
Thank you.
Any other questions? It seems people are shy. So let me get some questions from the Internet. And this is for Dr. Meeker. And the question is there phthalate exposure associated with employment in the pharmaceutical industry, which is significant in Puerto Rico?
As Dr. La Cruso mentioned, it has been several different phthalates can be found in pharmaceuticals or supplements. I'm not aware of studies looking at workers in pharmaceuticals. There are some studies looking at other PVC manufacture where there are elevated exposures to DEHP, but I'm not aware of any for pharmaceuticals. But yes, we do acknowledge that there is, or at least was, quite a bit of pharmaceutical activity in Puerto Rico, and actually they do make up for some of the Superfund sites down there.
Okay, and are you guys going to look at other chemicals other than phthalates that could lead to ROS formation and the cascade that you're showing?
Yes, that's one of the reasons why I was looking at the trichloroethylene metabolite,
yes,
because that's another chemical of interest in our center.
Okay, and while I've got you, there's a question related to, whoops, it just went away here, DEHP and DBT as a cause of boys born with genital abnormalities. Do you know anything about that?
You want to handle that, John? Let's change wands.
So this is referring to, I think, a lot of the rodent studies from the 90s and early part of this century, as well as the study by Shauna Swan.
Right.
So DBP and DEHP in animal studies at high doses are associated with male reproductive developmental issues and anomalies. And then Shauna Swan's study of about, I think it was a little over 100 boys in her 2006 and 2008 papers, did find an association between increased metabolites in the third trimester, DEHP, and some other, I want to say DDP and maybe one or two others, and anogenital distance in boys, which is the marker of androgen insufficiency in utero, which is had been used in rodent studies up till that point, and she adapted it to humans. But not much has been done since then. I think there are a couple other studies from other countries coming out just now. I think a couple are somewhat consistent with that, but then one or two were inconsistent.
Okay, so any other questions?
Hi, this is Mark Badaloni from EPA Region 2.
Mm-hmm.
So just to follow up on the point about the use of the large pharmaceutical industry in Puerto Rico, and I think it was Dr. Meeker who stated that they might be doing house dust samples, but they didn't do any yet. Not sure if you're familiar, but EPA, Region 2, in collaboration with CDC, has been doing a pesticide survey down in Puerto Rico in the last year or two, about 500 homes, which is white for a whole assortment of pesticides, but they also decided to do phthalate analysis, and we're just getting the results in, and what we are finding is a lot of phthalates, mostly by ethyl hexyl phthalate in the wipe samples. So I just mentioned this more as an observation than as a question, but I wonder if
that's great. Could you give your name again?
Sure, it's Mark, M-A-R-K,
mm-hmm.
Madaloni, M-A, two D's, like David, A-L-O-N-I. Is Heather Henry on the phone? Because she could connect us if you want.
Yeah, that would be great.
More information. Yeah, we're just getting the results now, and I'm a toxicologist and a risk assessor, and I've just been doing some of my little things that I do here, and I have found that the levels of the diethyl hexyl phthalate, they're in load, mass per unit area, but I would say that they're above what I would describe as a risk-based level, as far as looking at the reference dose and slope factor for DEHP. So they're certainly starting to send up a flag, and certainly in my eyes.
Yeah, I did not know about that.
Not me.
Right. Well, again, I'm not surprised because it's literally we're just getting every week our lab down in Edison, New Jersey, is doing another batch analysis. So we're getting the results in. We have about the results of 100 wipes so far, and out of those 100, about 70% are positive for phthalates. So, and while they have a whole gamish of other, you know, pyrethrins and a couple of organophosphates and organochlorines and some carbamates and
We're collecting samples to potentially look at those as well.
So we got a lot of things going on there, but we certainly, in addition to all the pesticides, we do have these.
Okay, and I do know there is a PVC manufacturing facility on the south part of the island, but we're focusing on the north for now.
Okay, that's a great connection. And Heather Henry is on the line, and she'll work to connect you guys up. So there was another question about phthalates causing inflammatory responses directly as well as producing ROS. Is that true that they have two different mechanisms that could be involved?
I don't know of, you know, directly meaning chemically, not involving a cell. I don't know of one. One thing phthalates, well, I can think of one, actually. Some phthalates can actually chelate divalent cations, which could include iron, for example, and that may have some consequences. There hasn't been a whole lot of toxicology work done looking at that. There's also the proposed mechanism of acting through the PPAR pathway, but that's not, what I would consider direct. I would consider that a cell-mediated mechanism. And there's also the possibility that the phthalate itself in its metabolism, oxidative metabolism, releases and generates ROS, reactive oxygen species.
Okay. And the last question here for related to the oxygen species generator, there's a question related to iron ascorbate, if that's ever been looked at.
If it has, I don't know it.
Okay.
That's the honest answer.
Okay. Any other questions from the phone?
Yes. This is Jim Trotsko from Michigan State University.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Rita. Congratulations on all three of your talks. I just want to make a comment that relates to all three talks, actually. It turns out the classes of chemicals that both talks addresses are classified as epigenetic chemicals. And more recently, one new concept to explain the Barker hypothesis, in other words, in utero exposures to these kinds of chemicals, can in fact obviously induce oxidative stress, obviously in the mother, as well as in the developing embryo and fetus. And what oxidative stress does to all the cells of the body, both of the mother and the fetus, is to cause the three different types of cells in both bodies differential responses. In other words, the few adult stem cells are going to behave abnormally when stressed by redox changes. In other words, you can get either increased or decreased numbers of stem cells. And also, secondly, when you talk about, and you stress this, the whole body exposure to these chemicals will affect the immune system, but at the same time, they affect the target cells of the released immune cytokines. So the complexity of what really happens cannot be studied reductionalistically, because once that chemical gets in the body and it induces the immune system to secrete IL-1-6 cytokines of one sort or another, they are also acting on the epithelial and endothelial and fibroblast cells, which also have been primed by the same chemical. And that's going to complicate our understanding of what any of these chemicals do to bring about a health effect. It's just a comment.
Well, I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why preterm birth remains unresolved in terms of, you know, the rising rates and difficulty in therapeutic interventions. It's a hard to study. And there aren't any, you know, there's no good animal models either, because the activation pathways for parturition can vary and do vary remarkably from one species to another. So, you know, it's challenging, and so I think what you have to do is you have to do it like you do any good science, which is where you choose your models carefully and you choose your interpretation from those models carefully.
Right.
Within the limitations, and why we want to work on multiple levels. And so one thing I'm really excited about with the Superfund collaboration is the opportunity to get human samples from women who have measured exposure levels. It just offers some real opportunities for translating some of the work we find in our experimental systems now to some of these tissues and samples from the population, and why I really enjoy working, you know, with John as an epidemiologist, that there are opportunities there that to take it all the way up to the human. And it's going to have its own limitations. But, you know, putting the pieces together from using different models, if it starts to build a consistent model, then I think we can draw firmer conclusions. And if the models aren't consistent, then we have to go back to the drawing board.
Right.
Okay, great. So there's a couple of questions for Anne. One of them was that if people wanted to know what was the actual concentrations in your highest percentile group. So is Anne on? I wonder if we lost Anne. Are you there, Anne?
Nope. Oh, sorry, I was on view.
Oh, you're
talking
on.
Into the phone.
Okay.
So there's not an easy answer to that. Because, remember, the exposure period is roughly 5 years and 9 months long. And so you could get into the high exposure category either by having a very high exposure for a short amount of time versus a moderate exposure level for a longer amount of time. But I don't think you can get in there by having a low level of exposure for the 5 years and 9 months.
Okay. So you focused on the neuro effects, but were there other effects? What was the really strongest effect that showed up?
Well, in this particular study, we've looked at cancer effects,
yeah.
We've looked at reproductive effects, including birth defects. We are going to follow up. We found associations with oral clefts and neural tube defects that we're going to follow up with our newest funding from Superfund. But the strongest effect in this particular study was for the drug use.
Mm. Okay.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm just looking. There was nothing, you didn't notice birth abnormalities like cleft lips and palate, spina bifida and things
yes,
like that?
Yes, well that's what, so I was saying in our previous study which looked at the birth outcomes, we looked at preterm birth and low birth weight and did not find an association with either of those. But we did find an association with two types of birth defects, oral clefts and neural tube defects. Because it was a cohort study, you know, when these defects are relatively rare, the results, while suggestive, were unstable. And so now we're going to follow up with a large case control study looking at these birth defects across Massachusetts. We're going to extend it beyond Cape Cod to across Massachusetts and include Rhode Island, where a lot of this pipe was also installed.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, thank you all very much. We've reached 3 o'clock, and it's time to close. But I have still more questions here from the internet, and those will be conveyed to the speakers, and they can then answer them and send the answers to the people who asked. And if you have any other questions, feel free to send emails to the speakers. I'm sure they'd like to correspond with you and answer your questions. So thank you all very much. Thanks to the three speakers and to everyone on the phone. And have a terrific rest of your day.